Call the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development into order. Long list here today. The first one is to finish up work on a bill we carried over from last week, Senate Bill 1539. We now do have the fiscal paperwork. And I think we just need a motion, Senator Morris.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
This is the bill that on the task force on virtual school governance that moves the date forward a year.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1539 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Morris moves that Senate Bill 1539 go to the floor and be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. We are waiting for final amendments on the Senate Bill 1540. And so they should be walking through the door soon. So I think we can keep that on hold as we move into some of these other more technical housekeeping bills. So let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill, public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1538. If you could give us a short summary, Administrator Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1538 authorizes the Oregon Executive Investment Board to approve or reject Oregon University System funding requests and achievement compacts, clarifies duties of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, transfers authority for licensing career schools from State Board of Education to HEC, clarifies applicability of OUS of statutory provisions related to borrowing through State Treasurer or holding funds in State Treasury, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. Tim Nesbitt. Walk us through your amendments and
1538.
I'm sorry.
Not what you wanted to do.
I do want to be here on 1581.
Okay.
And so let me close that public hearing, and I apologize. I do want to open up a public hearing and a work session on 1581. We got misordered on our agenda.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1581 requires education entities to enter into achievement compacts with Oregon Education Investment Board, describes terms that must be included in achievement compacts, identifies positions to be under the direction and control of the Chief Education Officer for matters related to design and organization of Oregon's education system, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. Tim?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tim Nesbitt. I am the manager of the Governor's Oregon Education Investment Project and staff to the Oregon Education Investment Board. The Governor and I and others were here before you last week for an informational hearing on Senate Bill 1581 and walked through the provisions of the bill at that time. I can work from that testimony and call attention today to the amendments coming to you and a package of amendments labeled Dash 5. I do want to state that in regard to Sections 1 through 13 of the bill, which relate to the Chief Education Officer, there are no changes. And I did want to supplement what you heard from the Governor last week to inform you that we are proceeding with recruitment for that position and through a national search firm, and we expect to have the Chief Education Officer hired by the end of April. I think we shared with you the job description for that position. I do want to call your attention to the requirements, and in particular the Governor's preference for a Chief Education Officer with education experience. So I wanted to make sure that was on the record. Further, now this suits your plan. I wanted to go through the amendments in Dash 5, starting from the list the Governor shared with you last week, so I can equate that summary of changes to the language in the Dash 5 amendments. So that's the handout you should have just received. It shows nine items, 1 through 7, the governor covered last week, and I'll speak to the origin of 8 and 9 in a moment. So as noted in governor's proposed amendment number 1, we are expanding the scope of achievement compacts, or the reach of achievement compacts, so that in addition to an achievement compact between the Oregon Education Investment Board and the university system, there will be additionally individual achievement compacts between the board and each of the 7 universities. That language is incorporated on page 1, lines 13 and 14 in section 17, in section 14, excuse me, and also on line 4 and 5, same section, where we are referring to the president of the university as the counterparty to an achievement compact with the board, since there are not, in effect, boards at the university level currently. Item 2 relates to the role of the Quality Education Commission, and here you have to turn back almost to the end of the Dash 5 amendments. It's on page 9. Where we capture the concept that the OEIB will work with the Quality Education Commission to identify best practices for school districts and the costs and benefits of adoption of those best practices by school districts. You'll remember that when we talked about achievement compacts, we talked about the ability to identify districts which are beating the odds with similar student populations spending roughly the same dollars per student. We want to be able to work with the Quality Education Commission and tap their expertise and experience in order to do the diagnostics for districts which are beating the odds, so we can best identify what are the contributing factors in those circumstances and what the costs will and the benefits will be from applying such practices to other districts. So that's the intent there. Item 3 was incorporating a reference to the level of funding under the quality education model, which we now develop, which the Quality Education Commission now develops statewide. But in this instance, making a calculation for each district and its relative level of funding to the optimum funding identified in the quality education model. This is contained in section 14, sub 3C. And you'll see there between lines 11 and 24. There is that language, and at the recommendation of the staff to the Quality Education Commission, we added a reference to making these calculations based on the state school fund distribution, which will enable the proration or assignment of proportionality here to be done most effectively. In regard to what we had listed as item 4 on the amendments list you received last week, those are incorporated in a new section 15 on page 5, where, as was the case in the earlier draft, we will in this legislation direct the Board of Education to waive for the next fiscal year, 12-13, the reporting requirements, not compliance with the underlying regulations, but waiving the need to file a lengthy report of how that compliance is being effected. This waiver is already in effect this year by action of the State Board of Education. We're proposing that it continue in effect next year to provide paperwork relief from districts which will be focusing on their achievement compacts. Again, in subsection 2 of that section, we're clarifying here that there will be no penalty not for failing to comply with the reporting requirement, but we, in this instance, would still have enforced by the Board of Education the requirements to comply with Division 22 rules, which, and if there's non-compliance, complaints can be filed and enforcement can be effected in response to a complaint. In subsection 1B of section 15, we have added a provision, as we noted in our amendments last week, that would allow the board, it's may, to the extent feasible, to direct the Department of Education to waive, as permitted with and consistent with federal law. The requirements now in effect for local district continuous improvement plans. When you look at what achievement compacts will spell out in terms of goals and targets to be achieved, in effect, districts will have to enter into improvement plans in order to achieve their targets. So this is somewhat redundant, and we're assuming that over time, the implementation of achievement compacts from year to year can take the place of or be co-equal with, operate in tandem with district in continuous improvement plans. This is something we've heard a lot of support from the superintendents that this would be helpful if we relieve them of duplication of effort here. There's another piece here which I'll come back to in a minute that relates to what's item 9 on our last on our summary sheet. In regard to the involvement of teachers and other employees, we had one two-page section we shared with you last week in our handout. And these have now been broken into four pieces. So the first of these is in section 14, sub 5. And this is language which actually is identical to what you saw in our handout last week and identical to the bill with the addition of the last sentence, with the exception of the addition of the last sentence, clarifying that the open communications must be provided during each education entity's public budget process. We've had discussions with groups such as the Oregon PTA of their interest in making sure that this means two-way communications. That is our understanding, and that is obviously what occurs during budget hearings at the district level, and that's the intent here as well. Further in section 16, you'll find, and this begins on the bottom of page 5, you'll find the establishment of the Achievement Compact Advisory Committees in K-12 districts and education service districts, the language identical to what we shared with you last week, reformatted per legislative council. And just to clarify, because in section 17, the timing pieces are clarified, as we propose this and as is represented in sections 16 and 17, the Achievement Compact Committees will be formed this year after local districts have entered into their Achievement Compacts, which they'll do between roughly April 1 and June 30 of this year. So in tandem with the budget process, and this is consistent with the printed version of 1581, districts will, as part of their budget process, adopt their targets and enter into their achievement compacts by June 30 of this year. Thereafter, they will set up in K-12 and education service districts achievement compact committees along the lines described here. And those committees then will work on the implementation. Again, similar to what we see with continuous improvement plans. That implementation work will also then inform the development of targets in subsequent achievement compacts. And it's that work which will lead to a report from these district achievement compact committees in February of each school year, first being February of 2013 in this instance, that will go to the local board and that the local board will attach as well to whatever targets the board sets. But it's also important to remember that the board has the final decision-making authority here on what targets it sets as part of its achievement compact with the Oregon Education Investment Board. And then finally, as we shared with you in the language that the governor presented last week, we've provided mechanisms for further feedback and advice to the Oregon Education Investment Board, first from state associations representing educators, administrators, and governing board members of school districts and education service districts regarding collaborative models and resources, including professional development opportunities that may be used by the districts and their Achievement Compact Advisory Committees for the achievement of student success. Similarly, in the second portion of Section 18, this same invitation would exist to associations representing similar groups in the post-secondary world, or community colleges and universities, where a different model other than the Achievement Compact Advisory Committee would be needed to effect the goals of collaboration and professional development opportunities. So we would wait to hear from those organizations, and the board would receive their recommendations by September 30 of this year. Item 6 on the list of amendments from last week was language intended to provide more focus on achievement gaps. You remember when Superintendent Nancy Golden from the Springfield School District presented to you on January 20th and again on February 1st, she shared with you a sample compact. And that compact, as well as the sample compacts that the Investment Board included in their report to you, their December report to you, as well as others being developed as models by other districts, all include a reference to the disadvantaged student groups. They include racial and ethnic groups. They include English language learners. They include special education students and others, students from households in poverty being the other group. All of those would be, and all of those which are now tracked in the Oregon report card and other data reported to the Department of Education would continue to be tracked in that way. We had not in this legislation, until this language was added, captured the intent to make sure that when a district sets its targets for particular goals and measures of progress, that it pay attention to the disadvantaged student groups. That is now clarified in and made part of Section 14 in 14.4b, and in subsection 7a of that section, there is a language that allows the board to be more specific in terms of the reporting that will be done at the end of the achievement compact period to better inform the board on how the results were achieved. And those reports could well be further disaggregated as to each of the subgroups that I described. So that's the intention there with that language in section 14.4 and 7. Also, we wanted to be more explicit, item 7 on the list of amendments, in our reference to the 40-40-20 goals, so that it's clear, and this is bottom of page 2, top of page 3 on the dash 5 amendments, that we're not just talking about an ORS reference, so it's clear to the reader we're talking about our high school and post-secondary completion goals, the 40-40-20 goals, which are now incorporated in ORS 351.009, as well as a projection of the progress needed to achieve those goals by 2025. So that guidance will be provided by the Investment Board when it forwards its achievement compact to the local districts, for the local districts to set their targets. Finally, what came forward after we presented to you last week was a request from Oregon Health Science University to be a little more specific about what their achievement compact might contain. We had already received the sample compact from OHSU, and they had already agreed that this will work for them. And in fact, what their compact focused on was the enrollment of and the attainment of degrees by Oregon residents in programs for which the state provides funding, such as in medical, dental, and nursing programs. That was the intent, and so we have made that more specific here. Those are the amendments which the governor approved, in which, in the case of 1 through 7, he brought to you and we described last week. In addition, there was the request to have another portion of Section 15, another provision added to Section 15 about assessment, and that would give the Oregon Education Investment Board the authority, it's a may, not a shall, to direct the State Board of Education to waive, as permitted by federal law, the implementation of statewide assessment systems described in ORS 329.485 and implement, in lieu of that system, alternative systems to measure progress and performance. Our thinking here is that you'd be giving the board additional authority, not authority they asked for, an authority they would use judiciously, in the sense that the Board of Education now has been doing the work on not just OAKS, the OAKS system which is referred to here, but the next generation system, which is currently being developed in collaboration with a consortium of states called the Smarter Balance Consortium. That work we think should continue. Actually, there are two questions raised by this provision. One is, can we or should we have a better system? I think the answer to that is resoundingly yes, especially since we now have Common Core standards, we're a lot more focused on coordination towards college and career readiness. But that is the work going forward now and may go forward for another year or two before there's a development that we call final. At that point, whether it's the system we have now or the new system, do we need alternative systems in place? That's a decision which we think can only be made when we look at the new system. But in any other case, we think there has to be a balance struck between flexibility for the district and consistency to give us accurate bases for comparisons from district to district or school to school so we know that students are reaching benchmarks. So with those principles in mind and with the caveat that following a discussion at the Oregon Education Investment Board yesterday, we think the board's interested in alternatives. We think they're going to defer for the time being to the Board of Education and rely on the work being done there. In other words, we don't think this is an authority that the board would be quick to use, but one which if your committee feels this should be here, we can certainly work with that. As long as you understand, we think we're on a timeline where we want to make sure that the Board of Education and other groups, you may hear from Superintendent Rob Saxton, who's chairing the Task Force on School Accountability, are working on to give us a better statewide system. And we want to stay in sync with that, and we want to be deferential to their work. With that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, those are the amendments. As the governor urged last week, we hope you will adopt these, incorporate them in Senate Bill 1581, and we look forward to your moving the legislation.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, I'm curious. I've done a lot of good work on this. Who's going to do the achievement compact for OYA and the School for the Deaf and the Blind?
Mr. Chair and Senator Byer, we do not envision achievement compacts for OIA or the School for the Deaf and the Blind or for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. So we understand that achievement compacts or something like them may make sense in the future, but we're not prepared to say for the 2012-13 year that those should be incorporated in this arrangement.
And I'm curious, the Achievement Compact Advisory Committees for the school districts, why wouldn't you require the same thing for the universities?
Mr. Chair and Senator Byer, that's why we left that provision open and asked for recommendations back by September 30th. You have very different arrangements in the community college and university world. You have faculty senates.
Right.
You have arrangements beyond my ken in terms of how curriculum was developed and plans are set. And we just
hope
didn't
that
think
the presidents will just work it out.
Well, we want to hear, under the provision we provided here, how they think they would want to work it out.
Okay. Senator. And I guess the last question for me would be, the OHSU provision in terms of Oregon students only makes sense. Why wouldn't we do the same thing with regard to the university, the other seven?
Senator, and Mr. Chair and Senator Byer, I think the answer to that is the Academic Strategies Committee of the Higher Ed Board has already been working on what they had viewed as a set of performance compacts. We'll look at their work and adopt them in some fashion as achievement compacts, looking at each of the seven universities in terms of its unique mission within the largest system of higher education in Oregon. They call that managing the portfolio. And we think we'll have to pay special attention to the mission of each of the universities in doing so. I will share with you that at yesterday's board meeting, we looked at what it will take to implement all of this for the coming school year. And the governor, as chair, appointed two subcommittees of the board who will engage in rulemaking should this legislation be enacted. We'll be ready to do so in March. We will have a separate subcommittee for post-secondary and one for K-12 and ESDs. And each of those will relate to an advisory committee which will set up to inform the process. So we will further develop the content of the achievement compacts for each of the universities as well as for the university system in that process.
To be determined.
Senator Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nesbitt, I apologize for a question out of the blue because I try not to do that, but I just saw all these explanations now. And my bosses at OHSU are not going to be very happy with me asking this question. I'm just going to warn everybody about that up front. If the state of Oregon is paying OHSU money, giving OHSU money to train future physicians, nurses, all sorts of healthcare professionals, then that's in part at least workforce development as well as education. And we know that there are certain kinds of healthcare professionals that are more needed than others around our state. And I wonder whether any consideration has been given to including benchmarks or achievement standards for focusing the work that OHSU does on actually promoting people going into the fields that we actually need in Oregon, especially given the work that we're trying to do in healthcare transformation, where more people will have access to primary health care but won't have doctors to see. More people have insurance but won't have doctors to see. And it's not just doctors.
Mr. Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, we've had this discussion generally in terms of post-secondary. There has been consideration in the sample compact developed by the community colleges for better assessment of how students move from completion of their certificates or degrees to jobs and to productive roles in the economy. That is certainly something which any of the institutions could choose to add to their achievement compact. It's also something which we will spend more time focusing on. There's this such specificity is not precluded by this legislation, but it's not something which in the first year the board has felt competent to undertake.
Thank you.
Any questions?
One more with permission,
okay.
Then, Mr. Chair.
Let's hold off. We'll have some other witnesses, and we'll keep you in the bullpen.
Thank you.
If that's okay. We're on Senate Bill 1581 on the Dash 5 amendments. We have a number of people who have signed up to testify. I would respectfully ask those of you who have signed up to keep your comments short so that we can get everyone in, submit your written testimony as opposed to just reading it aloud. And with that, speaking of Rob Saxon, I'll call up Rob Saxon, Sandy Husk, and Betsy Miller to the stand.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm Rob Saxton. I'm superintendent of the Tigard-Tualatin School District, and I'll let the folks who join me introduce themselves, if they would.
Sandy Husk, Superintendent Salem-Keizer.
Betsy Miller-Jones, Interim Executive Director, Oregon School Boards Association.
So I'm here this afternoon because I'm a member of the Superintendent's Vision and Policy Task Force, and I wanted to make sure and let the committee know that the task force has asked me to convey to you that we're in favor of Senate Bill 1581 in support of that. And in addition, this legislation is supported by COSA and the COSA board, who gave Senate Bill 1581 a unanimous vote of support. I wanted to talk to you just for a few minutes specifically about the education compacts. And I'd like to start just with a little bit of a story. 2 weeks ago, the Oregonian wrote an article reporting on the graduation rate in the state and used the Tigard-Tualatin School District as a positive example. So I wanted to talk about that. A few years ago, when we talked about dropout rate, the dropout rate for Tigard-Tualatin would have been reported at 1.2%. And we don't talk about that anymore. Now we call it a four-year cohort graduation rate. So it would be students who graduate in 4 years with an Oregon diploma. And our rate was reported at 82%, or 82.5% to be more specific. That's not all that we would want it to be. We'd love to see our graduation rate be 100% in 4 years, but we're just not there yet. But the reason that the Oregonian was interested in reporting on Tigard-Tualatin's rate is that our demographics are almost exactly representative of the demographics in the state. If you look at the percentage of students who are free and reduced, or Latino students, students of color, whatever the case may be, we're within 1 or 2% on almost every demographic of the state average. And yet, at the state level, the graduation rate was 67%, and ours was 15% higher than that at 52%. And so it is something that is notable just because our demographics look so similar, and yet our dropout rate is really different. And so I've been asked by a number of people, what is it that Tigard-Tualatin is doing, and to talk about that a little bit. One of the things I think that Tigard-Tualatin has done is that for the past 9 years we've had a strategic plan that the board has put in place. And within that strategic plan we've been really specific about targeting what our graduation rate, well, we used to say dropout rate, now our four-year cohort graduation rate is. And our target for this year was 83%. And so we missed that by about a half of a percent. And that's something that we need to work on. We're never satisfied when we don't have students who graduate in 4 years. But our graduation rate target within our strategic plan for next year is 85%. And so we've got some work to do between now and the time that we complete or get that data back next year. Our strategic plan doesn't come with just that goal, because a goal of graduation rate is really important, and it's specifically important when we talk about the 40-40-20 goals that we have set out with the state. But within that graduation rate, there's a whole bunch of other work that has to be done. Students don't just graduate. They have to be really highly capable readers in order to be able to access content and get to graduation. So we have reading targets. We also have targets about closing the achievement gap, or targets around the percentage of our students that meet on all four college readiness benchmarks. And the reason that I want to talk about that is because I believe in education that when we're really specific about what it is that we want to accomplish, and we lay that out publicly and say it's our goal as a district to have 83% of our students graduate on time in 4 years, and we're going to set the sub-targets for that, and we're going to do the work to cause that to happen, that we're very effective at reaching the targets that we set forward. And really and truly, what we have set up in our strategic plan are the exact kinds of targets that we're talking about having set out in the education compacts. And we really could take the things from our strategic plan and lay those out in the compacts. And because as a district, we've been public about what it is that we're attempting to do, and we've been intentional about what it is that we're attempting to do, we've come very close to achieving that. And I really believe that as a state and as a collective, when school districts set out to do that, and many school districts do currently, but when school districts set out to do that, and they're very specific about that around achievement compacts, and it's very public, we're going to be much more likely to achieve the kinds of goals that we want to. And I think that really is the power of the compacts. It's something that we've been able to do successfully, and I wanted to point that out. The last little bit that I would share about the bill that's before you today is that I do have a little bit of a question about Section 15.1c around assessment, and that's new in the document as I've seen it today. Because I have been the chair for the Task Force for Accountable Schools, one of the things that the task force has been asked to do by the legislature is make recommendations around what assessments we should be using as we move forward and we look at the Common Core curricula that really is kind of a national or a set of national standards, and look at those assessments. There are two big assessment compacts out there, the PARC and the Smarter Balance Assessment. And we've taken a look at those and some other assessments that we've considered, and our recommendation to the legislature at this point in time is that we need some more time to make those decisions. They're really important decisions around assessment, and I wouldn't say that just one assessment is the answer. There may be multiple assessments that we need to get that done. But neither of the two big national assessments are yet completed. They're not written. They're not ready to go. And so for us to make a recommendation about something we don't have a finished product on didn't make any sense to us. So what we have said is we're a member of the Smarter Balance Assessment Consortium. We think we should continue on as a member. We think probably that's the right assessment for us to go with over time. And there may be other assessments that could be used to inform school districts about what kind of success they might have when their students do take the Smarter Balance or whatever assessment we eventually choose. And so as you look at that language in 15.1c, I just want to make sure that it's consistent with allowing us to really do the research and the study that would take to make sure that we have the right tool to assess Oregon students against the Common Core and assess their progress towards the Common Core. Thank you.
We'll hold off questions.
Mr. Chair, can we clarify that?
Senator Beyer?
I'm not sure that I'm understanding your point there. Are you saying, as I read that system, it seems to say that the department has the ability to waive and let a district choose an alternative. Are you supporting that or opposing that?
Senator Haas, Senator Beyer, excellent question. I was neither supporting nor I wasn't doing either one. I was saying I think that we need to read that and make sure that that's new in the bill today as I looked at it. And I want to make sure that whatever we do there doesn't preclude us from making really good decisions down the road around what assessment that we should choose. So I just was expressing that I hope that there's some caution and that we fully understand, because I don't yet, exactly what that would mean for us.
The way I'm understanding it, it allows them to waive it at your request. So I think that's consistent with what you're asking.
All right.
I have a couple brief comments, and I'll try to say a little bit more about that. Again, Sandy Huss from Salem-Keizer. I think the enthusiasm that you're hearing from the superintendents, and I was here last time we spoke on this, is this does give us a system across the state to be able to see how we're doing from district to district in a way that will allow us to build on the momentum of success stories. Anytime we picture changing the way we measure success, especially if we do it individually, there might be a risk of minimizing our ability to have the power of doing that across district lines. I think that's why Rob and I said we just need to think about that part, and we really do want to see what the Smarter Balanced Group comes up with before we would weigh in on whether or not it's a good idea to allow us to opt out of that. The second thing I wanted to say is that this is a powerful moment for us in our history to be coming to you with something around instruction and planning and measuring of success that we agree with across professional associations. You've got two of us seated up here today, but there are many others in the audience that have come forward and said, let's work together on this so we have a way of improving education for all children in Oregon. As Rob highlighted, many of our districts already have strategic planning and goal-setting processes that will fit nicely into this, but we don't have consistently ways of doing that across all district lines. This will allow that process to be much more consistent. The goals are critical, but what's much more important than the goal is the action you take after you analyze what you can do to make things better. And that's what's going to move this forward. So I want to tell a quick story about McKay High School again. I mentioned them in kind of a general way last time. It's a high school that you could say pretty easily is the most heavily impacted by poverty and non-English speaking students in the state of Oregon. Last year, their reading scores with Oaks went up 24%. The results for economically disadvantaged students went up 45 to 70%. English language learners went up 9.3 to 40.7%. And those are the English language learners that are currently being served by the program. There are hundreds more in that building who have successfully exited. And the way that we believe that you get that kind of dramatic success in a highly, highly impacted English language learner population, population of poverty, is when every adult in that K-12 system, and now it can be pre-K through higher ed, is focused on the data and those groups of students, and we think about it all the way through the pipeline. So I picture this as building capacity across the state and being able to articulate and calibrate all the way from four-year-olds through higher ed. So I leave this with my motivation is looking at the faces of not just the McKay kids, but the faces of all the students in Oregon experiencing that kind of success and the celebration we will feel as a community when we know that working smarter across district lines, across organizational lines, helped us get there.
Thank you.
Thank you. The top priority for locally elected school board directors.
Why don't we start with your name and ID?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Betsy Miller-Jones. I'm the interim executive director at the Oregon School Boards Association, and so I'm representing locally elected school board members. The top priority for locally elected school board members and directors, and thus our organization, is supporting ways to improve student achievement and success. The achievement compacts that we're talking about today represent to us an opportunity to build greater collaboration in school districts around shared goals and better outcomes for students. The Board of Directors of OSBA voted unanimously to support the concept of achievement compacts. Our members want to develop a homegrown system of improving student achievement and accountability, one that's collaborative and designed at the local level. Our current one-size-fits-all system under NCLB contains prescriptive sanctions and does not meet the needs of schools or students in Oregon. Our members support the efforts of Governor Kitzhaber and Superintendent Castillo to seek a waiver from No Child Left Behind. We understand that the concept of achievement compacts is a key component of Oregon's waiver request. OSBA believes the achievement compacts reflect what school board members and educators have been looking for since the unintended consequences and faults of NCLB first became apparent. The punitive one-size-fits-all system of interventions and oversights of NCLB have not served Oregon schools, and most importantly to all of us, Oregon students, well. We've got an opportunity now to tailor outcomes to the unique circumstances of our individual school districts. Our 197 school districts and 19 educational service districts have very different student populations, different community challenges, different community beliefs and values. What may work in Beaverton might not be right for Burns. So we see these achievement compacts as a way to share best practices and still give districts the flexibility they need to make the compacts fit the needs of their students. School board members do look forward to working collaboratively with superintendents, administrators, teachers, and other education stakeholders to make sure that these compacts work for our students. Increasing student achievement is the cornerstone of the work of school boards. OSBA's support of achievement compacts reflects the unwavering commitment of school board members statewide to find solutions that are research-based, locally designed, and meet the needs of our local communities. To be successful, we believe these compacts must be accompanied by state-level resources, additional mandate relief, and relief from the No Child Left Behind Act. Thank you.
Thank you. And for the record, you're supportive of the Dash 5 amendment?
Yes, we are in support.
As are both of the superintendents here. Okay. Questions? Senator Morse.
Thank you. To maybe make an analogy, if you take a line of business and you have 10 independent businesses all doing the same thing, you'll have some businesses that are high achievers, high performance, high outcomes, and other businesses that just kind of hang on. I mean, that's just a function of the world of business. Education really is not a great deal different. And my question is that when you have part of the education system that is underperforming and chronically underperforming, what kind of a response would come from the board or through the districts or that would address that chronic underperformance? Because right now I don't see anything in the bill that addresses that.
Mm-hmm. And we have talked about that obviously a lot at a district level. I'll answer it at a district level, and then I would say at a state level, I think it's yet to be decided. At a district level, my response to that is it depends on the analysis. If I have a set of schools that aren't using the curriculum that was provided, and the other schools are using the curriculum, and you can see that who's using it is getting results, and these that are not using it are not, it's a pretty easy analysis. You need to use the curriculum. If you can see that the teachers that have been assigned to that building don't have the skill set or the certification that they need for the kind of students they're working with, then it's a different set of solutions. Maybe you need to look at the way you're assigning teachers. If it's a community that's lost hope and you have staff that are telling you that they don't have high expectations for students, that's a different solution. And so I think that there are remedies or structures that can be put in place that would allow a thorough analysis that's specific to the kind of things that we know makes a school really effective. And that we need to recognize that we have to analyze what the district is doing to support those schools. And so in the case of a worst-case scenario, that you have a district that isn't able to provide the support to any schools, again, that's going to be a different solution than if you have a district that's struggling with some schools. It's easy for me to see at a district level because I feel like we've been doing it. To move it to a state system, I think we're going to have to work together to figure that out. But first, we have to have the tool to do the analysis. And I know it may sound simple when you think about comparing businesses to say, well, why haven't you had that? But we haven't. Because the tools we've been using, I would say, are more likely to compare neighborhoods than they are to compare the quality of the instruction and the results of the learning inside of each building.
Thank you.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I was going to ask earlier, I think I can ask of you all just as well as Mr. Nesbitt. When I think of the term compact, I think of a two-way agreement. And I see a lot about what the schools are, at every level are being asked to contribute to this compact and their side of the bargain. it's a little less clear to me exactly what you're getting in return. Certainly, those of you that are already doing really well are going to be asked to offer stuff to districts and schools that are similar to yours but are not achieving the same remarkable successes that you're describing. I guess I'd like some reassurance from you, if you can give it, that you feel as if you're going to be supported by the OEIB and its and the DOE in achieving your achievement compacts and moving forward to get that to those goals.
Do you want to take it?
Well, I'll talk about it a little bit, but then you may want to back me up. So, Chair Haas, Senator Steiner Hayward. What I would say is that I feel like there really is kind of a two-way street on this situation around the compact, and that certainly it requires a level of support and a level of funding in order for school districts to kind of, to achieve at the levels that they want to, and money has been very, very tight, as we all know. To me, it is a little bit of a chicken and egg question in some ways. I feel like we need to make sure that we perform at a level and that we're able to say to the people of Oregon, here's what we're going to achieve as school districts, and here's what we're going to achieve with the children of the state with these compacts. And we're making that commitment. We're setting that out as our target and our goal. And what we need then in return is we need to make sure that we have adequate funding and support to cause that to happen. We need to have structures in place that align Oregon's education system, PK through 20, so that we as a K-12 system have an opportunity to make sure that we have students who come prepared to kindergarten, ready to learn, and that as we move through and we work towards graduation and we start to achieve 40-40-20, that we hand students off so that they're able to get to the 40 and the 40 part of that. And so that whole stretch is going to be in there, and that what we need to do is say we're going to perform at a level, and with that we're going to catch the we're going to have the expectation that we're going to have an appropriate funding level, and we're going to be able to achieve at a rate that will cause people to want to fund us at that level. I know that's sort of out there just a little bit, but at this point in time, I think it's what we have, is let's go out and perform and cause that to happen.
And I'd say it's about ownership, which I think maybe is a short way to capture what Rob just said. If we change our energy and our focus, or at least agree to be more consistent across the whole state so that the conversation can have momentum, we're counting on that the people of Oregon will want to look at resourcing us in a different manner.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. At 2:15, we're going to close this public hearing. We're not going to get to all of the people who have signed up, so I would really ask that the people who we get to speak directly to this bill, this amendment, and as brief as possible. Sarah Norton, Rob Wagner, and Dana Hebert.
We're here all the time, so go ahead.
All right, Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Sina Norton, and a couple hours ago I was teaching verb tenses to 37 sixth graders in Borey Middle School. I'm also a regional vice president for the Oregon Education Association, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of the OEA. Oregon educators have long been at the forefront of demanding transformation of our public schools to ensure that all students have an opportunity to succeed in every Oregon community. Toward that end, OEA embraces the goal of a seamless, unified system from early childhood all the way through post-secondary to make certain that every student has access to a quality public school. Oregon educators also strongly believe in providing the necessary investment to our schools and students in order to improve for the best future for all of Oregonians. The work of the OEIB will continue well past this session, and as a result of Senate Bill 1581, it will soon hire its first chief education officer. The OEA believes that the chief education officer must have a strong and tangible experience in public education, be a real collaborator, and bring all Oregonians together with a thoughtful vision on how to make Oregon's public education system a success for everyone. Another central component of Governor Kitzhaber's effort through the Oregon Education Investment Board is the creation of the Achievement Compacts. Oregon educators welcome the accountability and fully embrace setting goals and identifying the resources needed to reach those goals. The Oregon Education Association has been working closely with the Governor's Office and other education stakeholders on the amendments to Senate Bill 1581 and will support this work so that the Achievement Compacts stay focused on making a difference for all of our students. It is critical that the Achievement Compacts require collaboration between the district and the educators charged with delivering in order to help students succeed. It is essential that the compacts provide a meaningful opportunity for professional educators to develop, evaluate, set, and meet the district's goals for student success. In order to achieve the goals put forth in the compacts, schools need the ability to collaborate within themselves, within the districts, and between the districts in order to achieve what they need to. Research, and any classroom teacher will tell you, that standardized test scores are not the best measure of student success and an incomplete measure of student growth. The achievement compacts should measure the things that really matter: learning, conditions, class size, individual student growth, and teacher quality through formative evaluation processes and 100% licensure standards. The OEIB should focus on the significant barriers to learning, such as economic conditions, level of disability, language, and lack of parental involvement, all of which play a large part in determining the level of success of Oregon students. I know these factors well as a current classroom teacher because every day 37 individuals walk through my classroom door bringing 37 different learning challenges and 37 different possibilities for greatness. There is no additional funding allocated with these compacts. It's important to recognize that school districts are dealing with crisis budgets. We cannot expect our schools to continue to do more with less. Oregon cannot expect 100% results with only a 65% investment. We must address this disinvestment in public education so that every student has an opportunity to succeed. Conditions for success are different for every community. It is the parents, teachers, the school, and community leaders in those communities that know what is best for their neighborhood schools. The achievement compacts should reflect what the local community wants and needs for their students in their schools. A leading predictor of student success is, in fact, family income. Poverty directly impacts a student's ability to learn. We must recognize that students are having problems with food and housing insecurity, lack of access to health care, and I have plenty of grumbling tummies most days in my own classroom. We're all in this together, students, parents, teachers, administrators, and public officials. Educators believe in accountability and are not afraid of high standards. As we expect our schools to perform to certain standards, it just makes sense that the compacts should include reciprocal standards for elected officials who are responsible for providing the investment necessary for great public schools for every student. While the legislation includes an extremely aggressive timeline for implementation, OEA believes that there is still much work to be done to be assured that these compacts will function in the best interest of all our students. OEA is appreciative that the governor is offering amendments that address some of our concerns and support Senate Bill 1581 with the amendments that were described in the last hearing. We will continue to work with all those interested in education in order to increase student achievement and provide access to a well-rounded experience for every student. In closing, I wish to share a reminder that public education is distinctly different from business. Public education serves all students and every one of their families. I stand with my 37 students each and every day as a professional public school teacher and carry on the journey towards excellence, be that academic or personal. We work hard to support student achievement regardless of socioeconomic conditions, disability, or other special education need, language, parental involvement, and for that matter, public investment.
Thank you. We'll move on to Rob.
Yeah.
Be careful of what you say when it comes to verbs and verb tense because of who you're sitting next to.
No misplaced modifiers or gerunds.
Chair Hess, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Wagner, representing the American Federation of Teachers Oregon, along with the Oregon School Employees Association, my counterpart, Tricia Smith, who may not have an opportunity to testify today. We just want to remind you that we're over 33,000 education professionals across Oregon. I'm here presenting testimony in support of Senate Bill 1581 on behalf of David Reeves, who is our faculty member who teaches English language learners at Portland Community College and who is president of AF2 Oregon and a member of the Oregon Education Investment Board. I will focus on just three brief points in favor of time. I know we're up against the crunch. So he stresses these in his letter, and I just want to provide them for a little bit of emphasis. First, AFT Oregon has appreciated working with the governor and education advocates and community stakeholders in addressing the critical issues affecting education at all levels. We supported Senate Bill 909, establishing the OEIB, Senate Bill 253, establishing the aspirational goals of 40-40-20, and President Reeves has been an active voice on the OEIB, pushing for robust measures of achievement, targeting key inputs which truly measure the wealth of educational experiences of students at all levels. I know he looks forward to continuing that role as this process moves forward. Second, AFT Oregon feels it is critical to work collaboratively to gain buy-in from education professionals, parents, community, and civic leaders from across the state. If we are going to achieve this goal, we must recognize the value of these voices. We must build on best practices and realize that student achievement is a shared responsibility. Included with President Reeves' testimony is the AFT Oregon Statement of Principles on Student Success, which looks like this. It's a document that was assembled with the input of our education professionals from across the state, and it highlights their views on the importance of a bottom-up, locally-driven, community-level focus and the need to involve education professionals in the development of achievement compacts. As we have seen, top-down models such as No Child Left Behind have not proved fruitful, and Oregon has a chance now to build on the energy we saw from the OEIB community forums to include all stakeholders in this process. We appreciate the bill and the amendments presented here today, which specifically address the concern, and the ongoing commitment from the governor, in which he expressed yesterday, in continuing outreach and involvement from stakeholders and community members. Finally, we can't back away from the challenge of funding. Oregon education programs have never fully recovered from the constitutional property tax caps of the 1990s. With the state forecast showing another more modest drop, hopefully we are finally bumping across the bottom of the ocean of the Great Recession. But given the lack of stability and adequacy in our revenue system, we must realize that we all need to be out in front with the message that economic revitalization is part and parcel with our strategic investment in education programs at all levels. AFT Oregon appreciates Governor Kitzhaber's linkage to the funding issue at every forum, and our members share his view that investment in education programs are inextricably linked to our economic success as a state. Thank you.
Chair Hess, members of the committee, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Advocacy Director with Stand for Children. Good afternoon. We are supportive of Senate Bill 1581. We think the achievement compacts are the critical next step from Senate Bill 909 that we supported last session. And the law specifically requires goals to improve outcomes for historically underserved subgroups, and we support that aspect of the legislation as well. We're most excited after you pass this legislation to be involved in the work that comes next, which is developing the process for setting achievable but ambitious goals for all students, and then specific goals for students of color and English language learners, providing targeted supports and interventions to the schools and districts that aren't able to make progress toward those goals on their own. We just wanted to add, in addition, we're feeling a strong sense of urgency to act now. Rob Saxton mentioned our graduation rates. In addition, Oregon's been unable to make headway statewide on a troubling achievement gap. And of course, as you've just heard, education is underfunded at every level.
we, under these incredibly challenging circumstances, we know that some schools and districts are achieving impressive results for students, and I think you heard from two superintendents of two of those kind of model districts today. The achievement compacts are a tool that can help us better understand what those districts are doing, and then it's our job, the job of advocates, legislators, the Oregon Education Investment Board members, to use that tool to find out what's happening in those districts and make targeted investments in those practices so that they begin to benefit more students across the state. Thanks.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for our panel? Thank you all.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. And in what I think will be our final panel, we'll move to the private sector. And I'll call Steve Buckstein, Betsy Earls, Jeremy Rogers.
Chair Hess, Co-Chair Morse, and members of the committee, my name is Steve Buckstein. I am founder of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank in Portland. I'm passing out a more detailed testimony, so I'll try and keep my remarks brief here. I'm here to oppose Senate Bill 1581 because I believe that it continues or lets the legislature continue to fall into what I call the trap of bigger is better. The goal of unifying everything from early childhood through age 20 education cannot be accomplished without pushing power and control even farther away from the people who should matter most, parents and students. The public commentary that was mentioned in the last panel is great, but this is still a top-down model. The bill, one of the things that concerns me in the bill is that giving the new chief education officer control, even partial control, over a number of leaders in the public education system is basically just continuing that trap. It's bad management policy. Before you approve any further Oregon Education Investment Board legislation, I'd like you to ask yourselves how it squares with some of our previous big reforms. I know it's before your time, or most of your time in the building, but in 1991, the Oregon Education Act for the 21st century was overwhelmingly passed, I think unanimously, if I remember correctly, in this building, at a time when Governor Kitzhaber was then president of the Senate. It was full of new committees, new high school SIM and CAM tests, which have been abandoned since then, and there was a promise from the legislature in 1991 that that big revolutionary reform, as Vera Katz called it, would produce, quote, the best educated citizens in the nation by the year 2000. So how's that worked out? As I think you all know, the Education Week annual education report card for the last 2 years, 2010 and 2011, gave Oregon a C-, rated us 43 in the country, not exactly the best in the nation. Why haven't such revolutionary reforms worked before, and why do we think they'll work now? That revolutionary reform was just on K through 12, but as one educational researcher wrote for us in 2005, part of the reason they don't work, or a big part, is they, quote, suck power upward and away from parents and students into top-down, centralized, and inflexible political arrangements where special interest groups have more political clout. This causes accountability to decline and results in higher per pupil costs and lower educational results, exactly the opposite of what I know you're all trying, we're all trying to achieve. The answer is really to produce an even broader revolutionary reform. In answer to this, there's now an attempt to produce an even broader revolutionary reform, which is the OEIB. Instead of just K through 12, we're now looking at pre-K through age 20. Another central planning system. I'm sure the governor and the people who he appointed in the investment board are very smart people. I know they're very smart people, but no such group can hope to design a system that meets the needs of all Oregon children and their parents. In conclusion, I gave you a copy, second page under my testimony, of a Wall Street Journal column that one of our academic advisors, an educational researcher, had published in 1991, a month after the 21st Century Act was passed in this building. It was published the day that the U.S. Secretary of Education flew to Oregon to congratulate us on that act. And basically in our editorial, we said maybe he'd want to hold his applause. And I just want to quote you the last paragraph of that article. You can read the whole thing yourself. But it's titled Education by Committee in Oregon. And what it said was, quote, "To be revolutionary, educational change must be systemic. It must reform the system, not add to it. Oregon's educational reformers are unwittingly legitimizing the very system that needs reform. Well-meaning politicians have once again increased state control over education in order to mandate desirable goals. The Oregon Plan provides the nation with an important lesson in reform," and again, this was 20 years ago, "how easy it is to fall into the bureaucratic trap of good intentions," unquote. I think when you read that whole article, maybe not all of you, but I think a lot of people will say this could apply to the current revolutionary control reform 20 years later, the investment board. I think it's time to stop increasing state control of education and start moving in the other direction. Thank you.
Okay. Go to Betsy and then Jeremy.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI has about 1,600 members across this state, and our members employ about 200,000 employees. So I think as representatives of those employers, we have a very strong interest in education reform. And that's why we supported Senate Bill 909 last session. The promise of 909 was, and I think continues to be, that by coordinating teaching and learning standards across the spectrum from pre-K all the way through 20, Oregon will be able to meet its 40-40-20 goals by 2025. We believe that the Achievement Compact framework that's been set out in 1581 and the Dash 5 amendments is a critical part of an overall plan that will get us to the 40-40-20 goal. Several other pieces, of course, are needed to make up a fully functioning system, and we've talked about those, I think, with several of you, but Senate Bill 1581 is a critical first step to that. Achievement Compacts provide an outline for the state to set up its learning and teaching expectations and the strategies that are needed to achieve those expectations. Further development, obviously, is going to have to take place soon, but we can make that the next step going toward 2013. We think 1581 is an excellent place to start with those. And I'll end there in the interest of time.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify. My name is Jeremy Rogers. I'm with the Oregon Business Council. I'll be very brief. OBC is a statewide business organization that engages our members in working on big, thorny public policy issues. One of those is education, and we've had about 20 years of experience at OBC working on education, a lot of it under the leadership of our president, Duncan Wise, who wishes he could be here today. Unfortunately, he couldn't come down. OBC would like to just let the committee know that we strongly support Senate Bill 1581 and the overall vision of the governor and the legislature with Senate Bill 909 and the Education Investment Board. See that the achievement compacts and the responsibilities of the chief education officer are critical next steps kind of on a long road of reform. We see this not as a centralization, but rather, particularly with the achievement compacts, as an opportunity for individual districts to develop accountability structures that work well for them and that, provide transparency and expectations for their communities, but that work on an individual basis. So we think it's a very strong step forward. Strongly encourage you to pass this legislation this year. And Duncan wanted you to know if you have any questions for him. He's happy to answer those after this hearing. Thank you.
Questions of this panel? Thank you all. We are in a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1581. I do apologize for those of you who didn't get up here, but we've had a couple of hearings, and this is a long ways from the finish line. The process is still very public as this bill moves through our process. And my intent here now is to adopt the Dash 5 amendments and move it on to the Ways and Means Committee.
Senator Morse?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated 2-8-12 to Senate Bill 1581.
Senator Morris moves the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 1581. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, as a leap of faith. I move Senate Bill 1581 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Morse moves Senate Bill 1581 with a due pass recommendation to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Senator George.
Colleagues, I'll be voting no on this referral. I appreciate what the governor's done as making education a huge part of our discussion. My concern comes back to what's been said by a number of folks so far, which is local control and local innovation. And every time we've looked at education, we have superintendents that are doing amazing things at the local school board level. And if the bill said that the chief education officer or the Oregon Education Investment Board could say yes but could never say no to our superintendents, I'd probably vote for it. But that's not the situation. What I fear is that what we're going to see is this great innovation that we're starting to see at the local level somehow be choked off by a political system. And so not so much as a criticism of what the governor's trying to do, because I think what he's trying to do is really key, but as a warning sort of that we need to make sure that this particular process is from the ground up, not from the top down, which I think was echoed through a lot of the testimony and including a lot of the testimony that I think the governor's staff has put in. I just want to vote no, because I'm not sure the language is there to protect local innovation in this process quite yet. So otherwise, I'm happy to see the bill move forward, but I hope that we can keep injecting local innovation in this whole process.
Okay. Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Senator Morse eloquently stated, it's a leap of faith. I'm going to be supporting this today. I think there's a lot of work to do. I think we made the commitment when we voted for 909, and it's too late to turn back. We need to fulfill this thing out. I do think the governor's vision is a good vision. I think there's a lot of work to do. I think we've started a restructuring of the education system, and it's outcome to be determined. But we need to move forward.
Okay. Senator Morse?
I do want to say that I think this is a bold transformational effort, and it is time that we did that. Before we move on any of these education measures, though, I want to make sure that the discussion starts off with an introduction that says education at every level in the state is underfunded, from early learning, K-12, and especially our universities. And so we have to go in with that understanding. And I think people expect us to be smart and set goals and high standards. And I think that is the goal here. And I think there's already been an effect of what the OAIB and its goals are trying to do, as we see superintendents and schools already starting to react as the building blocks are being put into place. So I feel good about moving this forward. And we understand that there is a certain leap of faith and an ongoing work of progress. So with that, we'll ask for a roll call vote.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator George?
No.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Morse?
Aye.
Chair Hass?
Aye.
The measure passes, goes to the Senate floor with a prior reference to Ways and Means. And we'll close our work session public hearing on Senate Bill 1581. And we will open up a work session and public hearing on Senate Bill 1538 in the latest amendment is the -7 and 8 committee, if you have that on your screens, or if we can print it out. I want to call Bridget Burns and Andrea Henderson up here.
1538. Thank you. Oh, -7. How exciting. Okay.
Where are the signatures? We're focused on the 7s and 8s. This version. And we still need the 5s.
We're just getting them, huh?
7 and 8s incorporate the Treasury changes.
Okay. Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director, Oregon Community College Association.
So what you all have before you, hopefully, is the Dash 7 and Dash 8 amendments. We noted that there was a minor conflict between the Dash 4s and the Dash 6s, and then there was a Treasury amendment that was inserted into the Dash 5s. So at the end of the day, we figured out all the conflicts and determined the best path to move forward, and that is the Dash 7s are all the fixes. The Dash 8s are all the fixes plus the Treasury amendment. So we would be talking to you today about the Dash 8s. However, we, of course, wanted you to have as many options as you choose, and so that's why you have both the Dash 7s and the Dash 8s. She can speak more directly about the changes that took place.
Okay, but we need to pass the 8s only to take care of everything, okay? Mm-hmm. And for the record, the OUS system supports this bill with the Dash 8s, at least moving forward, and for the record, community college is the same way. And if you could, Andrea, just very briefly tell us what it was that you changed that puts the community colleges on board.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Andrea Henderson. The Community College Association is in support of this bill with the Dash 8 amendments. The Dash 8 amendments do several things. Very quickly, as Senate Bill 909 and 242 passed in the last legislative session, there were some differences in the approach that the this bill is intended to make it all align. Very briefly, the Dash 8 amendments remove the section that's currently in statute that deals with the performance compact for OUS, since that is being addressed in Senate Bill 1581, which you just passed. So to ensure that there's not a conflict between those two, the sections on the achievement compact, it removes it from this bill. However, provides that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission does have a role to advise the Oregon Education Investment Board in those compacts, but removes the specific statutory provisions that are currently in there. Secondly, the Dash 8s also provide some very specific language for HEC to define what the role of HEC is around specific student issues. And essentially sets up a process by which HEC will look at student achievement, articulation agreements, and other specifically student issues, and make recommendations both to the legislature and to the Oregon Education Investment Board, and back to local institutions as well as to best practices. Okay. Finally, the Dash 8s have the Treasury amendment that's necessary to fix that problem. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Why don't you stay put? Autumn, Wilburn, you signed up to testify on this.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Autumn Wilburn, Oregon Department of Education. I have just quickly scanned through the 7s and 8s. I was here to testify in support of the one-year delay of the transfer of private career schools to the HEC, which was contained in the Dash 4s, and the Dash 6s then reversed that. And via my quick scan, it looks like the one-year transfer is not contained in the 7s or the 8s. And we very strongly want the one-year delay on the transfer of the private career schools to the HEC.
Okay.
So we'd be happy to work together to make sure that that happens. And the reason why we would like the one-year delay is to ensure that it's a thoughtful transfer and that all the students are protected in the interim. And we're committed to making this work and committed to making it successful.
Okay. This can be repaired in ways and means?
Are others interested in making sure that it's...
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't think there was any intentional, my sense is. Okay?
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Nesbitt, did you want to weigh in here? Are you okay?
Senator, I think we're fine.
Okay.
We don't have, because of these late amendments, the fiscal light, and so we need a suspension of the rules to send this on down to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, while we're still in a discussion, if I may ask a question.
Sure.
And one of the things that has been unknown to me is the budgeting process, and this does address the budgeting process. How would the budget, what's the perception of how the budget would be presented from the OEIB to the legislature? Is it one omnibus sum of money and the OEIB makes the appropriations? Or how is this envisioned to work? Good point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, Tim Nesbitt, the manager of the Oregon Education Investment Project. What the Oregon Education Investment Board has talked about in the last two meetings is how to engage the governor's recommended budget process. And so what you will see coming to you will be the governor's recommended budget as you have seen in the past. It may be structured differently in terms of how it arrays the funding recommendations for you. But backing up for a second, I think the governor and his staff, Michael Jordan and his staff, has probably briefed you in different venues about how program funding teams will help to look at the recommendations in larger categories outside of crossing agency lines. So it's focused on education, healthcare, natural resources, et cetera. Within the education sector, the Education Investment Board will work closely with the program funding team, may have a member on that team, and will just built a schedule this year, which takes them through September when the budget's being finalized, but also gives them a point prior to the governor finalizing all the details of his recommended budget, where the investment board will weigh in again, and the governor chairs the board. So there'll be the dialogue with the board about the final framing of the governor's recommended budget. But what you will see will be, as you always have under current statute, the governor's recommended budget, the categorization of the funding recommendations may be different, and that's going to be the case statewide.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So we're at a work session. We need to suspend the rules and adopt the dash eights and move the bill to Ways and Means.
Do you wish to amend the bill first?
Yes, dash eight.
Mr. Chair, I guess that would be a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Before we move it. I move to adopt the dash eight amendments dated, 2-8-12 to Senate Bill 1538.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the dash 8 amendments dated 2-8-12 to Senate Bill 1538. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Now, I suppose we need to suspend the rules. Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 1538 without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time.
Senator Morris moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 1538 without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time. Is there any objection?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1538 as amended by the dash 8 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 1538 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. The bill 1538, Senate Bill 1538, moves to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Committee, for getting those out. One more big issue here to dispense with. It is Senate Bill 1540, the Omnibus Education Bill, and we are looking at the dash 10s. Before us today, it has seven or eight technical housekeeping issues in there. As you know, we won't go through the laundry list, but this version does not deal with the entrepreneurial language that Senator Morris and I were helping to clear up. Just still need more time to work on that, and we don't want to risk the passage of the bill and these other technical changes that we need to do. Excuse me, the dash 13s. We have a fiscal on the dash 10s that say there's minimal impact. One word was changed on the dash 13s, and we're still awaiting
word for that,
so we may need to...
We're getting the 13s.
A short session, and we're up to the 13s.
Mr. Chair, while we're kind of in a moment of pause here, I would like to make a comment about the entrepreneurial amendment that we are not looking to adopt today. I believe that that clearly some of the mistakes that have been made in ESDs have been at the hands of that encouragement, which was codified in statute, to be entrepreneurial, to include private activities as well as service to the public sector. I think that's a major flaw. What we did find is that there are some cases where those connections in rural Oregon have been thoughtful and productive. And so how we craft a solution that sets a little different expectation for what ESDs do needs more discussion, and it's not likely that we're going to come to a conclusion in this short session, but it is a very serious issue, and I think there's some direct attribution back to this statute for the millions and millions of dollars that have been swept away from education and lost, and so it is something that's worthy of pursuit in the future.
Well said. I couldn't agree more. Okay. We need to adopt the dash 13, suspend the rules, and send it to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash 13 amendments dated 2-8-12 to Senate Bill 1540.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the dash 13 amendments dated 2-8-12 to Senate Bill 1540. Discussion? Seeing none. Objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 1540 for the purpose of sending it to, without having the fiscal impact and revenue statements on hand at this time.
Tim Morris moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 1540 without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time. Objection? Seeing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, this bill, without those, I assume, is by prior reference to Ways and Means?
No, they go straight to the floor.
It does.
And the way this will work is it will not be dropped until the fiscal paperwork is submitted to the President's office. I am confident that because of the previous amendment, which had a minimal fiscal, that a one-word change won't change that. But that we were given the special dispensation to vote this.
Yeah. Okay, let's go.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1540 is amended by the dash 13. Amendments to the floor of the do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 1540 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with the do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I just want to point out that these are all technical housekeeping bills. The standard was there couldn't be any hot potatoes. We will get you a summary for your caucuses for explanation purposes of each little section and what the explaining what it does and why it was sought and by whom. We'll take a roll call vote.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Morris?
Aye.
Chair Haas?
Aye. Measure passes. Senate Bill 1540 goes to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. I'll be the carrier. And I'll close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1538. We're looking for Senator Cruz. We'll stand by for a minute or two in recess and till he gets here.
There he is.
Like I had
what
to.
Time
is
It's a long walk. SJR 201.
And I'll open up a public hearing on SJR 201. Do you have a quick summary yet for us?
Yes, sir.
Victoria?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Joint Resolution 201 proposes amendment to the Oregon Constitution creating the State Board of Education for the purpose of establishing policies for administration and operation of public elementary and secondary schools, public universities, and community colleges, and to appoint the superintendent of public instruction. Refers the proposed amendment for vote at next regular general election.
Senator Cruz, welcome. Your day has come.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. This proposal, I would like to take credit for it, but I can't because I consulted with people that are smarter than me on the subject, and it's a compilation of a whole lot of ideas. But I want to take you back to last session as a starting point. There's been general consensus that our education system has been in need of major overhaul for a long time. And what we did last session in two specific bills, one bill we made the governor the superintendent, and which may or may not be a good idea, but it was also the path of least resistance because we could do that statutorily because there was no change in the Constitution to doing that. And then, but we doubled down on that with the passage of Senate Bill 909, which created the Education Investment Board, also chaired by the governor. And so to a degree, we gave all authority technically over the education system to the executive branch of government. And I had issues with the bill, but unfortunately this committee had two hearings on the bill, sent it to Ways and Means, and then it became part of the education package, and which I've always been of the opinion that bills should sink or swim on their own merit, not as part of some compromise deal, and clearly there was a compromise deal on a whole number of bills, some that may have been good, some may have been not so good, but that was the way the process went. And so there wasn't a whole lot of opportunity for anybody to opine on what we were doing and whether it was a good thing or not. This particular piece of legislation I've had drafted a couple times now, and it's been after a consultation with a whole lot of folks in the education business as to what would be the appropriate way to administer such an important and complicated system as our K-20 education system. Clearly there have been disconnects in the system the way it has currently been configured. You know, Ms. Chair, we've sat here and talked about the need for K-12 and community colleges and higher ed to work closer together, and in some ways they have, but it's been kind of in fits and starts and nothing in a really comprehensive way. So when I started looking at what would be the best way to run a system, the first place I went was to local school districts. And I also looked at the way a lot of our major corporations are run. And the beauty in that structure is that they have boards of directors who set the policy for the enterprise, and they have a CEO of the enterprise directly accountable to that board of directors. And it is a system that has worked well for a long, long, long time in this country and works well at local schools. Having said that, as we have taken more and more authority away from local school districts, it is not working the way it should because they don't have the decision matrix they used to. But in looking at that, I said, okay, now if we're going to restructure the way we do education in this state, what would be a good way to do it? And that's how I came up with this board. Now, the structure behind it is an 11-person board. Three members would represent the OUS system, three members representing community colleges, and five representing K-12, one elected from each congressional district. That mix does not give K-12 the majority, which I don't think would be appropriate, but it does give them a plurality of the board, which I think is appropriate due to the importance of that particular segment of the system. And this bill does not take the executive branch out of the mix. The governor would still appoint all these members, but he would appoint the members from panels submitted for his consideration. For example, the OUS system would submit a list of nominees for their three positions, and the governor would select from that list. Now, and the same for community colleges and the same for K-12. Now, the logic behind that is that each piece of the enterprise would be in their best interest to put forth as nominees the people with the appropriate level of expertise in that enterprise to make sure that their case was as well represented on that board as it could be. And the reason this would have to go to the people is because it would be a constitutional revision, because the superintendent of public instruction would no longer be an elected position, nor would the governor be the superintendent. The superintendent would be hired by the board of directors and accountable to the board of directors. And just as an anecdotal story, my father was on the state board of education for 10 years. And he was chair of the board at a point in time, and I won't say who the superintendent coming on at that point was, but a new superintendent was elected. And my dad called him and said, I want your phone numbers so I can get a hold of you whenever I need to. And that superintendent said to my dad, I'm not accountable to you. Okay. Because the superintendent wasn't accountable to the board. The superintendent was elected. And now, having said that, is the governor accountable to the board? No. He is also elected. So if you look at a business model, and the education system in this state is a business, there's no question about that. And it should be run as a business. I mean, you can't, it's not clearly not totally private sector, but the principles should be the same. And so having the CEO of the enterprise accountable to the board who sets the policy for the enterprise, I think is absolutely appropriate. And that's what this measure would do. Additionally, one of the reasons, and I know the bill's not moving, and that's unfortunate. Additionally, one of the reasons I wanted to have this considered by this body at this point in time is that everything changes in 2014, and there are lots of changes. At that point, Castile's term is over, and the governor truly becomes a superintendent, but also the Education Investment Board in the bill we passed sunsets in 2014, so we either need to reauthorize that or do something else. My thought in putting this forward and letting the people have a say, because I think it's always a good idea to get the opinion of the people on matters of this scope and importance, if this had made the ballot, it would give the people a clear choice as to which direction they thought it was most appropriate to go in, to this sort of board or what the governor has put forward. And it would give us a clear point of decision to make in 2014. And also, if this ballot measure had passed, we would need that time frame to make all the adjustments. So, you know, clearly I'm not going to give up on this issue. I think this is a better management system for probably the most important enterprise we have in the state, and that's our education system. And, I mean, we will see how the investment board works over time. I know that you're working on a bill having to do with contracts and different things like that, and it seems to me that we're kind of doing a lot of this stuff on the run at this point in time. And quite honestly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just thought it appropriate, because we made inside this building, without a whole lot of public input, a major change in our education system. I thought it would be appropriate to give the people of Oregon a chance to tell us what they thought of the change, and this bill would have allowed us to do that. And I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. It's a constitutional revision.
Yes.
So it would be 40 votes and 20 votes.
No. The constitutional amendment is a revision, simple majority.
Mm-hmm.
And
the other way around.
Okay, then it's an amendment, whatever. I may be confused on that, but when we were drafting it, it was what Elsie told me, that this was the one that would require simple majorities to refer. So.
Senator Morris?
That would be an amendment. There still may be an opportunity to look more seriously at this model. I think one of the concerns that many of us have had is the power that we've transferred from the executive branch to, from the legislative branch to the executive branch. And this would go partway, to putting some greater balance into that. So I would encourage you to bring it back for consideration.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Morris, I will admit that trying to do something like this in a short session is a huge lift. But I thought it important to attempt to get something on the November ballot. But, Ms. Chair, just so you know, this bill will be drafted in the next full session of the legislature. Maybe we'll have a more fully fleshed discussion of it at that point.
Further questions? Thank you for being thoughtful and doing this. I really do. It means a lot to me.
Well, Mr. Chair, education is an important issue for me. You know that. We worked on a lot of stuff together, and I just think we need to explore any option we have to make the system better. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you. Okay, committee, it has been a full day. We have to be very careful and carry some bills over to Monday. I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 201, and I would like to carry over SB 1554 and SB 1566 until Monday. Without any further business, we are adjourned.